Hello, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the final series of our 2023 podcast, the Imaginarium series, recorded live at Bangalore Showgrounds on Arakwal Bunjalung land. This next session, titled Green Imaginings, is about climate change in fiction, featuring Eliza Henry-Jones, Mark Smith and Nell Schofield.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another sensational day at the Byron Writers Festival. Firstly, I would like to thank the sponsors of this session, who is the Byron Shire Council. And now if you could put your hands together and welcoming our next guests. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome to Green Imaginings here in the fabulous ANI Hall in Bangalore. My name's Nell Schofield, and I've been a long-time climate activist. I kind of first heard about climate change when I went down to Antarctica in 1988 and heard about that polar ice melting. And, of course, now we're hearing that the winter ice that didn't form this year in Antarctica, and that's a worry because it's basically the air conditioner of the world. We're also hearing that the Gulf Stream is collapsing and it probably will break down by 2025. Again, a big worry. I trained as a climate leader with Al Gore in 2007, and they were saying, well, if that happens, we're going to go into an ice age. But since then, they've discovered that we're way too hot now for that to actually happen. In fact, we're hotter than we've ever been in 100,000 years. So, you know, it's a pretty dire state of the world. It's hard for adults to comprehend, let alone young people. But maybe we can find some inspiration in fiction. And our two authors here today are working to do that in various ways in their novels, which are very, very different. But there are some strong similarities that we can explore a little later on. Eliza Henry-Jones is a qualified counsellor for grief and trauma and has written a gripping eco-thriller. It's set on a remote Scottish island haunted by the ghosts of witches. And Mark Smith is a schoolteacher who's written a book about grassroots climate action set in a Victorian surf coast town, which is very similar to the one he actually lives in. But, you know, it's wonderful what fiction can do. It enables you to go to places and let your wild imagination run free. So please welcome Eliza and Mark to the stage.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, both books set on coastal towns that are being ravaged by rising sea levels. And both feature single mums as well, trying to do their best to bring up their kids in an uncertain world. And both have teenage characters front and centre of the stories. In Salt and Skin, Eliza's book, there's siblings Min and Darcy Manigan, who travel with their mother Luda from their drought-stricken Australian farm to a remote coastal town in Scotland. Luda is a photojournalist who's landed a job documenting the impacts of climate change in this small town. And I wanted to start by asking you, Luda, how do the kids grapple with having their mother Luda work in this space?
I think it's an issue very much complicated by the fact that Luda is completely blinkered. Her entire reason for being when the novel starts is to raise awareness about climate change, to raise funds, to try and alleviate the effects, to try and, you know, take action. And this gets her into some pretty sticky situations. Fairly early on in the book, you become aware that she has actually taken a photo of her son without his consent or knowledge and published it in a newspaper. And similar to how images in the real world have sort of become these focal points for disasters and horrible global crises, Sam the koala, there's that image of the firefighter giving the water. I'm fascinated by how these images end up symbolising. So this image that she took of her child without consent ends up becoming the symbol, the image, the focal point for all of this climate-related activism. And he is not happy about that. You know, he feels betrayed, he feels furious, he feels, you know, he just feels violated. And, you know, and I think even in the best of circumstances, you know, for an adult, it's hard to articulate those sort of complex feelings. So for a young boy who's been uprooted, you know, he's having a bit of a time. And, you know, there's also a bit of intergenerational stuff, because as the story progresses, the daughter Min, who's a couple of years younger than Darcy, she becomes very entrenched in the sea and she starts deep diving. And she and Luda butt heads because she views Luda's activism as very, very human-centric and very focused on community and, you know, I guess buffering people from the effects of climate change, whereas Min is very aware of it being this wider, this wider global issue, and she's much more interested in alleviating and addressing the effects that it's having on the natural environment. So they're both very troubled kids, but I think the joy of writing about young people is that there's so much space for injecting in levity and warmth and humour, because I couldn't write a book without those things. I think how I delve into really dark topics is through incorporating that juxtaposition of light and humour and that ebb and flow. And yeah, young characters really do lend themselves to that.
Mark, your young character is 17-year-old Hess. He's a surfer in the town. His single mum, Imogen, is a climate activist. She's been running a grassroots campaign in the town for years. Mm. How does Hess deal with his mother being such a greenie, if you like? You know, because you have to go to school and the kids are working in the local power station and in the coal mine. So it's a sort of an outsider place to be.
To begin with, he takes the piss out of her mercilessly for being an activist and very much what he sees as a hippie activist. So she's got the Tibetan prayer flags around and she's got Che Guevara up on the wall, and she's in there. Hess has zero interest in what his mum is involved in. He's just interested in surfing. He's completely, you know, blinded by anything else, and it's all he wants to do when he gets home from school. But as his mother gets drawn into this campaign, that the premise being that there is a coal mine and a power station at the back of this little town, which is actually exists on the west coast of Victoria, and a young female exchange student from the Netherlands named Fenner arrives in town, and she's the one who draws Hess into the campaign. And Hess is a very reluctant campaigner, but once he gets involved, he gets very involved.
He sure does. Both of the books have this absent father figure. I was wondering how that works as a sort of a trope for action in this time. Mm.
I think it allows for a number of different streams to a narrative, and that's one of the streams of this narrative, because here's a young boy, 17-year-old, who's lost his father. Not only lost his father, but lost his father died in the surf. His father died surfing this legendary break called Razors, and he simply went out one day and disappeared off the face of the ocean. When Hess was 10 years old. This is 7 years later, and Hess is still dealing with that, but what it also allows you to do as a writer is you can bring in other male characters who become not necessarily father figures, but mentors for him, because he will go looking for them, and one of them being Theo, who owns the local surf shop. And Theo was actually meant to be surfing with his dad that day that his dad disappeared. So there's a story. It allows for that backstory. And it also, I think, allows... It kind of justifies the way in which Hess operates in a lot of ways with that absence. And in particular, it allows you to explore the relationship between a 17-year-old boy and his mum, particularly around once he gets involved with this girl, Fenner, around issues of consent and contraception and things like that. So it sort of opens the door to that in a way that may not have been there had they had, you know, your classic nuclear family.
Mm. And in your book, Salt and Skin, Eliza, there's another male who sort of steps into the breach, but I get the sense that you were really reluctant to let him in. At least Luda, the character, is very resistant at first to letting a man come and be part of her life again and to take control, I guess, in that father figure role.
And he was a late addition, so his name's Tristan, and he's kind of a bit of a lighter character, really. A friend pointed out he's like the only character in the whole book that's got a secure attachment. And slightly tangentially, but a friend recently pointed out to me that all of my books have got based around the premise of young people either having absent parents or dealing with their parents, you know, the fallout of their parents' very poor decisions. And it is a funny thing, I think, as a fiction writer, you know, you think you're delving into quite new areas of exploring new things, but actually you tend to sort of circle back to these things that you're subconsciously preoccupied with, and it can be quite confronting when other people pick up on it and you haven't yet.
The absent parent.
Yeah, the absent parent. And I think I think teenage characters, and I mean, being a teenager, you know, it's fascinating because there's all these patterns from childhood that are continuing to perpetuate, and at the same time, you're starting to really forge your adult identity, and they're these two almost warring forces and navigating that. And I think when there is an absent parent, the complexity and nuance of that increases, and I think it can create extremely fascinating characters and fascinating situations, and it's also quite fertile and satisfying to work in as a creative. Mm.
There's another character in your book who doesn't have any parents. His name is Theo, another Theo. He is a web-fingered foundling who's washed up on the beach, and he's sort of ostracised by the town as being a selkie, half seal, half human. Mm. But he's befriended by your two teenagers, Darcy and Min. What role does he play in the narrative?
I think one of the main things that he does is balances out and contrasts the fact that Darcy and Min have grown up with a photographer mother who has no sense of boundaries. So she has documented all these moments of their lives without ever actually engaging with them and seeing them and parenting them the way that they both really crave. And whereas, you know, Theo's washed up, no recollection of where he's been. The woman that ends up raising him is very traumatized by the media attention and refuses to let any photos of him be taken because she's worried about them being leaked and him feeling quite violated. So I was quite interested writing into that space where you've got this one young person that just feels completely skinless and completely, you know, just there's all these vulnerable parts of him are just in this public space versus this boy that's present as almost a narrative, but is, you know, his physical form is, you know, there hasn't been that same documentation and that same sense of his image permeating it. And I just found that quite fascinating. And I mean, they also, you know, Theo's very angry and he's held by the community. At the same time, he's ostracized and, you know, he can't read and he ends up drinking a lot. And he was quite a challenging character to write, actually. Mm. Not as challenging as Luda, but
he forms quite a fixation on Darcy as well.
Yeah.
He sees, I guess, possibilities and connection and someone who understands him in that character. Hess, he forms a relationship with Fenner, as you mentioned, who's this Dutch exchange student. Interesting choice of origin there with climate change and sea level rise. She suffers from anxiety. Why did you want to bring that element, I guess, of mental health into the book in the face of climate breakdown?
Number of reasons. Main one being I wanted to normalise that reaction. And I wanted to normalise it through the eyes of this boy, Hess, as well, because he has to negotiate the behaviours that are, you know, that are present with this girl Fenna, that happen through her anxiety, and also wanted to just explore that issue in terms of the way in which people deal with it, particularly young people, and how they deal with it, and how they can draw on peers. And once they bring they're willing to bring their peers into that area and to explain that this is what's happening with me, and I think that allows them to explore that relationship a little bit more as well. But principally, it was normalising that, because I've worked with young people my entire life, and when I first began teaching 30 odd years ago, a lot of the things that we are now aware of and we now have labels for, we didn't have labels for, and it was just a rough kid or a tough kid or a kid that didn't fit in. And now we have those labels, but we also have the strategies and at times the medications that can help those kids.
Eliza, you're working on a doctorate at the moment in climate change-related trauma, which is very topical and feeds into this discussion about how young people deal with it. How did it feed into your characters and the way you develop them?
I wanted climate change to be... I mean, it's a very important thread in Salt and Skin, and I wanted it to sort of just be this subtle thread that sort of permeates without being directly in focus throughout the whole narrative. So it's kind of a little bit... it feels a bit peripheral, even though it's actually central. And I'm interested in how we actually conceptualise climate change. You know, I think it's Tim Morton that talks about it in terms of being a hyper object. You know, it's so big that it actually is beyond our ability to sort of comprehend as one unified thing. And I mean, how do you make space for that yourself? How do you write about that? How do you write about, you know, historical places that are suddenly being impacted by this, you know, huge global thing? So that's... and I don't know that I don't have any answers to that, but I think we can talk a little bit about this weekend, but I think it's fiction's role to just ask those questions.
So they say that action is the best kind of remedy for anxiety and depression around the climate. The adults in your book, Mark, are very active. How do you motivate the children without being sort of didactic as well? I mean, I think that's the great challenge.
Yeah, it's a very fine line that you walk as a fiction writer. And no one sets out... you don't set out... I'm not writing a book about climate change. This is an adventure story about these kids in this particular town, and bubbling away underneath the surface is this issue, which they become involved in. And the motivation for me in writing this book was that I had been to the school strike for climate, the incredible rallies that we saw, particularly pre-COVID, where these kids, you know, were out on the street. I went to the one in Geelong, and it was so beautifully chaotic. It was entirely run by the kids. You know, there's no adult involvement, and it was just magnificent. And the passion that was there. I actually went home that afternoon and began writing If Not Us. Because I wanted to draw on that passion of those kids. And around that time, you may well remember when we had the previous government, and we were continually told, don't scare the kids, don't scare the kids. And I'd been at that rally. I didn't see scared kids. I saw angry kids. I saw kids who felt betrayed, and quite rightly betrayed. And then I looked at the young adult fiction that had been written around climate change, and you know what? It was principally dystopian, which was saying, sorry, it's all over, there's nothing we can do, we've just got to adapt to this dystopian world. And so one of the reasons for writing a contemporary young adult novel in this space was to demonstrate that kids still... you still have power, you still have the opportunity to act. And in fact, my character Fenna, you know, she stands up in front of these other kids and she says, don't you realise we're the last generation? And they are. Our teenagers now are the last generation that have time to act before this gets beyond the point. And so that's what I was driving at in with these characters. But again, as you say, trying not to be didactic, because the moment, you know, as a reader, the moment you feel as though you're being preached to, you can quite rightly throw that book aside, and kids multiply that by 100 because that's their life, is being told things. And as soon as they get a hint of this author's preaching to me, they will put that book aside.
Mm. This sounds like a pretty good moment for you to read a little bit from your book. This is the moment where Hess gets up in front of a crowd at a public meeting and tries to articulate all those things you're talking about.
Yeah. I want you to imagine a hall very similar to this one. This is exactly what I had in mind. And the hall is filled with coal miners at the back. The union is here in force, and they have their high-vis jackets on, and they are the coal miners in the town. And then you have the activists at the front who've called the meeting, and it's an open public meeting, so anyone can come. And Hess has been conned by his mum into being the voice of youth in Shelbourne to stand up and talk as the voice of youth at this meeting. But as soon as he begins talking, he gets howled down. A man stands up and he's a climate denier, and Hess is startled. And the man says, "Oh, be quiet and sit down," the man interrupted. "You're too young to understand. We don't want to hear what you've got to say, do we?" he asked, looking around the hall for support. "Do we?" he repeated. It seemed to Hess that time slowed then. The humidity in the room somehow added to the weight pushing down on his shoulders. A gust of wind rattled at the windows. He was sure everyone had shifted to the edge of their seats, waiting. A woman sitting near the front passed the toddler she'd been holding to the girl next to her. Then she stood up and faced the man. "I do," she said. "I'm with Hess." "I do too," yelled Muss, shooting to his feet like he just sat on a pin. "Me too," called Theo. "I'm with Hess." "And me," Steve Daly said loudly. The call rippled around the room as one after another. People stood up, some facing the interjector, others making a point of eyeballing the bully boys at the back. Eventually, most of the crowd were standing. Never one to miss an opportunity, Tina started the chant, "Hess, Hess, Hess," and it caught on as people clapped in time and stamped their feet. Hess looked at Fenner. She was standing on a table near the exit, her phone in hand, filming. She swung around and gave him the thumbs up. He'd never seen her do that before, but in the midst of the chaos, it seemed exactly the right gesture. Ruby and Oliver stood next to Hess on one side, Bear and Imogen on the other, as they waited to see what would happen. The Hadron workers were in feverish discussion among themselves, with lots of head shaking and pointing. Eventually reaching some kind of consensus, they edged their way to the aisle and left the hall. Felicity seemed reluctant to leave, but tagged along with her father. The man who'd interjected followed close behind, muttering to himself.
Now, this is drawn from
Real life experience,
deep experience. Yeah. You had to build a campaign in your own town and fight a coal mine and a power station. Mm. Mm. So how much of that, I mean, did you put into the book?
A lot. I still live in a small town called Anglesey on the Great Ocean Road in Victoria. And at the back of Anglesey was a huge coal mine and power station, which is owned by Alcoa. And Alcoa generated power there to transport to their aluminium smelter in Geelong. When the smelter was shut down because they couldn't keep up with world aluminium prices, we saw that as an opportunity to shut down the coal mine and power station as well, though Alcoa didn't see it that way. So it was a group of about 10 of us, and I remember this, we met in the community house in Anglesey, and we were going to take on a multinational company, Alcoa, based in Houston, through a long and, well, actually quite short campaign where we activated social media and lots of contacts that we had, that we did all the stuff like the stalls at the market and the signing petitions and things like that. But behind the scenes, we were approaching banks and shareholders and it was a real demonstration of the way in which environmental activism has changed. Now, it is a completely different thing to marching with signs and banners and then going home and putting your feet up and having a cup of tea and then picking up again. It's a totally different thing. And so I had that story there and I thought, what if I told that story through the eyes of a 17-year-old boy? And that's then where... And, you know, we were successful. In 18 months, we shut down the coal mine and power station. The power station has now been decommissioned, torn down. The mine itself is... the mine itself is now a lake and it's been revegetated all the way around. Not quite returned to what it would have been 50 years ago, but pretty close.
So yeah. Amazing.
It can happen. Can work.
So the piece you read out, we heard Fenner filming, you know, and the power of the image, the power of the moving image to get a message out there. It goes viral, and that's part of the part of the campaign, or the reason the campaign succeeds. Eliza, I wanted to talk to you about the power of the image in Luda's case, because she keeps transgressing these boundaries. She does it first with her son, Darcy, and then she does it again on the Scottish Island, where she happens to grab her camera just as the sea cliff is falling and a child is buried under the rubble. So this photograph again goes viral, and she justifies it by saying it's raising awareness for climate action, but what are the moral implications of the work she's doing, and is that what really is driving her?
I mean, that's something I grappled with the whole way through writing Salt and Skin. I mean, does something like climate change actually justify transgressing those boundaries, you know, as a parent with your child? Does it justify transgressing the boundaries of, you know, another family's grief after, you know, this horrible accident? Does anything justify it? And I kept circling back, and I don't really know that I have an answer. I mean, she, and part of her, I don't know that her behaviour really would change, but I think her approach does, and her awareness of the other people around her changes.
She's sort of ostracised by the community because of this action, this photograph, and it has resonances to the town's witchy past. So, you know, women were ostracised for riding whales across the bay and so forth and so on. You went to these churches, these kirks, where the so-called witches were incarcerated and tortured. How did that impact your sense of Luda, you know, and her alienation?
I think fundamentally what I wanted to explore in that context is the way that we really like to imagine that we've evolved beyond these patterns of violence and these, you know, huge horrific events, and we haven't. You know, they change shape, but they just keep reoccurring and reoccurring and reoccurring, and that really got under my skin when I was on these islands. And, you know, you can actually see the double hangman's ladder, you know, and there's a whole story about how I spoke about this yesterday, so sorry if anyone caught that, but, you know, it's meant to be worn more on one side than the other, because the hangman, of course, climbed up and down, but the condemned witch only ever climbed up. And something about seeing, like, the dungeon and, you know, the ways that these often quite marginalised members of the community were simultaneously thought to have these absolutely astonishing powers over the weather and the ocean and whether or not that community would have enough to eat. Like, it's quite a funny thing to grapple with. And, you know, and then the, you know, of course, the political and the religious context of the Reformation and, you know, all of that undercurrent sitting there, and the way that, you know, religion and politics are still kind of feeding into this interplay of who we other, who we behave, you know, who experiences violence, And happy Sunday, everyone.
Yeehaw. Would you like to read a little bit from your book? There's a section where Luda goes into the kirk and touches this double hangman's ladder and experiences this sight of violence towards women.
I would like to preface this with, this is not quite as dark as I'm making it out to be. I couldn't have written this book without having it warm and about connection and about yearning to feel loved and seen and empowered. So that, you know, saying that...
We might have chosen the wrong excerpt, but it just gives you a sense of that history, that reality for those women.
So this is Luda and her daughter Min being shown the cathedral on Big Island by the archaeologist Tristan, who, as I mentioned earlier, is like the one securely attached character in the book. So he just kind of bumbles around being very wholesome. They begin climbing the tight and narrow sandstone staircase. Kirk, Min thinks, not a church, a kirk. The women accused of witchcraft were put on trial here in the kirk, Tristan says, as they reach the first floor. This is the dock. Min stays near the stairs, not liking how close her mother is to the wood of the dock, not liking how Luda reaches out a hand to touch it. And this is the hangman's ladder from the 17th century, says Tristan, nodding at a double-width ladder leaning against the sandstone wall. Any idea why it's worn more on one side than the other? Luda's mouth twitches. Oh, is this the official kirk tour? I didn't realise. Should we be paying you? Tristan shakes his head. Such ungratefulness. Min closes her eyes and wills herself outside. But she can't. She is here, in the kirk, in her body, always, being pushed up close, too close to death. She is so sick of death. Well, the story goes that the hangman climbed up and back from the gallows platform. The condemned woman only climbed up, so the left side, therefore, got twice the wear. Luda spends a long time gazing at the dock, the hangman's ladder. She spends even longer lingering near the manacles that had bound the women. Min watches and feels as though she's going to vomit. Happy Sunday!
So both Luda and Min develop kind of superpowers on the island. Luda can see scars on people's bodies in the light of the island that they're living on. They live in what's known locally as the ghost house, with all the witchy markings around the walls. And Min, as you mentioned before, develops this power to dive underwater for extended periods of time, unusually long periods of time. What are you saying with those superpowers? How are you teasing out women's, I guess, persecution in the past with what is happening in the present?
I think firstly, what trauma and climate change both have in common is their ability, their very clever ability to evade narrative. And sometimes I think to do justice to the experiences of living through climate change and, you know, living through more personal trauma, you may have to, in my case, I felt like I needed to utilise these magical, fantastical elements in order to do justice to the truth of what I wanted to talk about. And something that really struck me when I was researching it, actually, is, you know, these apotropaic markings, these protective markings, they're quite common throughout Scotland, and some of them are concentric circles, and the idea is that bad spirits are trapped and they just keep walking these lines for eternity. And, you know, it's about keeping communities safe. And I was looking for these commonalities between Australia and Orkney because, you know, climate change is affecting both of these places quite violently. And I was just looking for patterns, and I didn't think there would be because, you know, the end of those folkloric traditions is widely thought to be around 1735 at the time of the Witchcraft Act. And, you know, colonisation and invasion happened in 1788, so quite a gap there. But the Ian Evans for the Australian Magic Research Project recently found out, discovered that there's actually all these examples of protective spells initially throughout Tasmania, and then he's since found them on the mainland as well. So just this idea that communities and people, when faced with the unfamiliar, when faced with being overwhelmed, you know, just like the light would have been different, the animals, the weather, you know, populations of people that have already been here for thousands of years. And so they, you know, they then reverted back to these old folkloric practices that their ancestors had used to keep themselves and their loved ones safe. And I think the narrative, again, there's that cyclical idea of things being cyclical.
But what about the breath, this idea of being underwater and being able to hold yourself calm in the face of death?
Oh, I like that. And I'm still preening a bit from gripping eco-thriller, you know. I mean, I really wanted to play with the boundary between the human and the non-human world, right? You know, there's that Selkie folklore, this idea of this boy washing up with no memory and being slightly more than human, this idea of this girl just teetering on the edge of what is actually humanly possible by just deep diving with only the air in her lungs. And I wanted to tease it out. And again, it just felt like the right way to find the truth of the story that I wanted to tell.
For you, Mark, in If Not Us, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Tim Winton's Breath. Because, you know, the surfers are out there on these huge breaks and they're getting pummeled and they have to hold their breath for long periods of time. It's like a rite of passage in your coming-of-age book for Hess.
It is. So, as I said, Hess's father has died at this particular break, which only breaks on huge storm swells. And he has never been out there, but he chooses one day, a completely calm day, to paddle out to find the reef. And he dives off his board down to touch the reef. And he is convinced that he may be able to feel something of his father. That this is the place where he knows his father died or where he disappeared. And he holds himself under the water there. He puts his foot into a fissure in the rock and holds himself there, holding his breath and looking around him. And trying to feel something of his father. Of course he doesn't, and that's the realisation for him, because he's been told, you know, you can go out there, but you won't necessarily find an answer. Some things, and as Theo put it, he said, sometimes shit just happens and unfortunately you've got to live with the consequences. But it also, on that day, Hess also realises that he needs to be out there not on a calm day but on a huge day. And so, and eventually that's the way he comes to terms with his father's death, is to go out there and to surf it on a massive day, where he's guided by another sort of figure, young man as well.
There's a sense of liminality about both of your books. You know, they're coastal towns. Yours, Eliza, you know, it's an island off an island that can only be accessed at low tide. How does this play out in both of your books in regards to those teenagers coming of age?
It's central to Hess's life is the water. It enables you to explore other issues as well, because anybody who's a surfer, you already know about climate change, because you notice. I've surfed for 50 years, so I've noticed over that period of time, surfing very similar breaks over that period of time, and how the water stays warmer longer into the season. How down south it used to be, you know, Easter around April, that was the turning point, and then you're into your 3-2 and your 4-3 suit, and now it's lingering into May and into June. So the water is staying, and now we have these different patterns where we have these big East Coast lows coming down and pushing easterlies. We had coconuts being washed up on the beach on the south coast of Victoria, you know, over last summer. So we're noticing it. So it allows me to explore that, and that's one of the reasons why Hess is alive to... He hasn't made the connection yet, but his mum helps him make the connection between what's happening in the water and what's happening with that coal mine out the back and the power station.
And Eliza, why did you want to put your characters on this very remote island that can only be accessed when the water is out?
I think in terms of, you know, being teenaged, I think, you know, being teenaged is like the ultimate liminal space, isn't it? And I was also very aware that I live on this little farm, and I wrote Salt and Skin during lockdown, and there was this real sense of being quite restricted. You know, I was in this little space, and that was where I could go. And And I mean, I don't leave my farm very often anyway. This is very exciting weekend for me. But just the details that you become aware of. We grow a lot of our own food. I have a little flower farm with my cousin. The one thing that makes less money than writing is our flower business. Just
that's saying something.
Yeah. You know, so we're very aware, and moving from the suburbs to this little farm and then being, you know, restricted to that space, I was very aware of the seasons. You're very aware of how a cold day impacts, you know, like we had a cold weekend in November, we lost our beehives, then all of our, you know, our blueberries happened to be blossoming at that time, then they didn't end up being pollinated. We lost all these established avocado trees, you know, the rabbit population suddenly explodes and start ring barking all of our established trees. You end up with fungal stuff, you know, the horse gets sick because there's bacteria stagnating in these puddles. And it's just these little rippling effects, and it's such, they're such small things, but it just gives you, there's an intimacy in it, I think, deep diving into place like that and seeing those effects at such a micro level. And I think an island gave me the ability to sort of replicate that. Subconsciously, I didn't think, oh, I'm going to create, you know, I'm going to turn my farm into this, you know, weird little island off the north coast of Scotland. But I think that definitely fed into it.
You're going back to Scotland soon to
Friday.
Promote the book. How do you think it's going to go down there?
I'm actually feeling a bit nervous. I'm doing a talk at Orkney Library, and I haven't been back there since I wrote the book. So I really, really hope I've done justice to it. And one of the things I was very rigid on is not actually calling it Orkney and not attempting to write the lived experience of that community. I used it as an inspiration. I used elements of it as a springboard to then create something that I took wild liberties with.
And Mark, what's next for you with this book? I mean, are you still teaching?
No, I'm not teaching anymore. Look, you know, one of the reasons that, again, that comes back to what Eliza was saying about keeping things close is for teenagers in particular, it's hard enough for adults to come to terms with climate change, but for teenagers in particular, it's so big. And it appears to be so far beyond their experience, and they're not responsible for it. So one of the ways that I do it with writing workshops and in talking about this book with students, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and that is to say, look, you know, it's very hard for you to influence what's going on in the rest of the world, but you can influence what's close to you. You can influence the way you choose to live your life, the way in which your family chooses to live their lives, and the things that you can do within your own space. And it's why this book, because this was my hometown. This is my hometown where this was happening, it was a demonstration of, you know, there is this wider issue of climate change, but there's so much happening close to us, close to home, that we can actually affect. And I know that there'll be people, and I agree with this, that you know, what we need, we're at the stage where what we need is wholesale systemic change, but that doesn't mean that we stop individually taking responsibility ourselves as well.
Yeah, there's a sense that in both of your books that these small voices doing what they can does make an impact.
Yeah.
Is that what you wanted to convey when you set out on writing this book, Salt and Skin?
Absolutely. Just the power of the individual and the ways that they can be key to breaking those cycles and those patterns of violence and those patterns of behaviour that have, you know, led to climate change.
And we have that incredible role model. When students say to me, but what can I do? What, I'm 14, I'm 15, and I only have to point to one person, it's to Greta Thunberg, and say, that girl, you know, who at the age of 13, you know, every Friday began going and sitting outside the parliament in Stockholm with her sign demanding climate action. She is now one of the most recognisable people on the planet. So, you know, that's your answer for kids who say, it's just me, what can I do?
magic realism. I want to talk about wild imagination as well, because that is obviously the theme for this weekend. Mark, you're talking about climate strikes and actual things that are happening in the world. Yeah. But Eliza, you've really let your imagination run wild with this book. And as you say, the climate is an undercurrent, not the thing that's in front of our face. Mm. How did that magic allow you to create all these characters and take them places that you didn't expect they'd end up?
Again, I think it just comes back to wanting to do justice to the truth of that story. And I think as a writer, when I'm putting the pen down to paper, in my case, typing really aggressively with two fingers.
Oh, you too.
Yeah.
I want there to be a sense of the characters breathing and having autonomy, and I want to feel like I know how they'd react to certain things. That's what I need. That's the one thing I need to know when I'm writing. And for this story, magic felt like the right way, well, magical realism, that element of the fantastical, felt like the right way to create resonance in those characters, to create a sense of them being breathing and a sense of the narrative forming around them in a way that felt as true as it possibly could be to what I wanted to say.
And Mark, did you find yourself moving into that territory, letting your imagination take hold with these characters?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And while my characters are grounded in no single character in the book is a single person, but you make those amalgamations of characters, and you bring them. Some of them arrive to you fully formed, and others you build as you, and they reveal themselves to you as you write them. But my principal character, Hess, one of those miraculous things, he just came fully formed. He was there. And as I said, I came home from that climate strike and I started writing the book, and I had this image, and this image was of a boy riding down a hill on his bike with a surfboard in the rack on the bike, his wetsuit in the crate, and he's hurtling down this hill after school. And that was it. Once I had that image, I had him. I had the character. I knew where he was going to be going. I knew how he was going to speak. I knew how he was going to interact with other people. All of those things were there.
Was there an image for you, Eliza, that you held on to, like an anchor through the writing of the book?
The final scene was my anchor. I knew where I was headed from pretty early on. I started writing this as a poem when I was very sleep deprived, with my little baby curled up on my chest, screaming a lot and weeing through his nappies. And during the process of writing this book, it's 108,000 words. I threw out about 150,000 words, but that little section of poem that I wrote in the notes app of my phone, that ended up being turned into like a paragraph. But that ended up almost word for word what the final scene of that book is. So that was my my touchstone. That was where I knew I was. That's where I needed to get to.
In the real world, Mark, you have been trolled in the wake of the publication of this book. Yeah. I mean, it is in school curriculums, I might add. When you talk about it, you hashtag climate action, climate emergency, words like this, tags like that. Yeah. Can you just tell us a bit about the way the book has been received by the Australian public?
The trolling was really only at the very beginning when it first came out, and at that stage I was still on Facebook, no longer. It was all along the lines of, why are you writing this to scare kids? Scaremonger, blah blah blah. And I must admit, I hadn't been anticipating. I probably should have anticipated it, that said, the book is now finding its way onto curriculum in sort of year 9, year 10 level, as a kind of a...
It's the dream.
Yeah, that's right. If any of you are in schools, then I think that there's a market there, there's a niche in there where we do want to be able to engage in this topic with kids, but we want to be able to do it in an optimistic way. Mm. And if we can demonstrate in some way that these kids have power and, you know, they have more power than they realise, and if they just need to know how to use it. And in that regard, then now I go into schools, I get welcomed into schools, and and that, you know, I either find students are on a topic like climate change, middle secondary school, they're either completely disengaged and it hasn't sort of raised itself in their world, or they are right onto it and they will, you know, ask the most incredibly incisive questions. And I think that's very much a reflection of what's been going on at home, and whether it's spoken about at home or whether it's, you know, come up in those sorts of discussions.
I mean, how realistic is that kind of optimism and that hope? I know there's a Dharma teacher up here who talks about, you know, living, not living with hope. So don't be hopeful, don't be hopeless, but be hope-free. And that kind of liberates you to be more powerful in the world.
Mm. It's hard. It's hard writing when I, as an adult, I'm deeply pessimistic about where we're going. But I don't want to emanate that pessimism to the kids that I am working with. I want to, you know, as I said, I want to activate them, and because that's where the resolution lies. And I also want them to, not necessarily, I think I often go into schools and I almost feel as though I need to apologise, because it's my generation and it's the generations that have come before me that have put these kids in the situation that they are in and the world that they are going to inherit. More so now, I've become a grandfather in the last, you know, in the last 12 months or so, and I see that little boy and I think, what sort of a world are you going to live in? And even talking to teenagers now, you know, if just to get the message home, I will tell them the world that you are going to grow, by the time you have children, the world as you know it now will be very, very different. And without trying to scare them, but still trying to activate them.
Mm. And what are your dreams for your children, your child, Eliza, and how do you think imagination and dreaming big, like you are doing in your work, how is that going to give them the kind of tools that they need in the future?
I have never thought about that. I mean, you hope you instill the things that, you know, your values in your children. I mean, I hope I raise a child that cares, and I hope that I raise a child that's kind, and yeah. And I think a lot of this stuff comes from that.
I'm wondering if anyone would like to ask a question of our authors up here today. Does anyone have a question? Yes, up the back. Can you use a loud voice?
Anytime my book is mentioned in the same sentence as Tim Winton,
tick.
I'm happy to take that. Thank you. Absolutely, an inspiration. Yes. One of the great things about Tim Winton's writing is that he can take you into spaces that he is intimately familiar with, that you may not be, but he can still take you there, and you can still understand it. And it's one of the things about it's difficult writing something that you are really passionate about, because you use a vocabulary that goes with that passion that a lot of your readers may not be familiar with. So you need to pull that vocab back so that you allow the reader in. And that's, you know, that's the great balancing act that writers like Tim Winton are able to do. And yes, absolutely an inspiration. I don't think anyone in this country writes about the ocean in the way that he does.
Mm. Oh, and Mark's book is young adult, but yes. it's enjoyable by all ages. Like, I really, really loved it, yeah. And I think you'll enjoy reading it as an adult. And mine is, yeah, it's for adults.
It's a, like, young adult is just it's just marketing. A book is a book is a book. If you're interested in it, go and buy it and read it.
Yeah. I guess when you say your book isn't for young adults, there is a lot of violence in there.
It's happy.
Well, it's magic, you know, and it is inspiring because it has all these magical elements in it.
Yeah, it's and I think as well sometimes, you know, things like, you know, underage drinking, drug use, violence, swearing. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it can be those almost surface things, even though I've written two young adult novels as well, and I find that thematically they're very similar, but just the way that you just tweak those surface things shifts. Yeah. So that's... Yeah, why I'd categorise it as adult, just because there is quite a bit of swearing. My husband's grandmother, who is 98, she gave me a bit of a stern telling off when she read this one.
Too much
swearing.
Too much naughtiness.
Bit too naughty.
You got one.
Yeah, another question.
Yeah. Just simple. The name of your book, please, Mark, it's not mentioned anywhere in the programme.
Oh, well, it's not us. And it actually is taken from a quote by John F. Kennedy.
If not us...
Who, if not now, when, which has always been used as a very powerful motivator for climate action. Yeah. You also quote in the front there Greta Thunberg.
Yeah. And that magnificent speech she made there at the UN climate talks, where, how dare you, you know. One of the most brilliant speeches. Imagine that girl in that situation, you know, talk about talking truth to power.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, thank you both for talking truth to power in your different ways. You know, you talk it to the church.
Yeah.
You talk it to, you know, the...
Anyone
that will listen. The big power companies, and they did. Well, they had to listen, so that was wonderful. Congratulations to both of you on your books.
Thank you.
And for inspiring us.
Yeah. And thanks to Nell.
Thank you, Nell. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.